Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. College graduates are facing one of the bleakest job markets in history. As companies continue to lay off employees, many are rescinding internships and job offers. Recent graduates who want to work for nonprofits will have an even tougher time finding a job. According to a recent New York Times piece, as the economic crisis creates so much demand for services, nonprofits are laying people off. Some, like the YMCA, might have to close hundreds of branches. Many college students and graduates have no choice but to move back in with their families. Some students are delaying graduation altogether. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, we did a show about how students are preparing for and coping with online learning, especially first-generation students and low-income students. As colleges debate whether to reopen or go online, they also face uncertainty. According to NBC, more than 500 colleges and universities across the country show warning signs of financial stress. Some experts warn that because of the pandemic, we could see a wave of colleges close for good because of their financial circumstances, and this would disproportionately impact low-income students. In May, California Governor Gavin Newsom proposed budget cuts to the California community colleges, UC and Cal State University systems by about 10%, and some colleges have already announced faculty layoffs. So how are students, graduates, and faculty dealing with so much uncertainty? Christopher Newfield is professor of English at UC Santa Barbara. He runs the blog Remaking the University and is the author of several books, including his latest, The Great Mistake, How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. Professor Newfield has tracked the plummeting of state funding to support public universities over the last 20 years, and he says we cannot muddle through this like we have in the past. Hi, Professor Newfield. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you. Dr. Jeff Stroll is director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He is co-author of the book, The Merit Myth, How Our Colleges Favor the Rich and Divide America. It argues that selective colleges primarily function as a way to fast-track the elite to ever higher status and end up contributing to systemic racism in the United States. Hi, Dr. Stroll. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Christopher, I want to start off with you. Let's first talk about how students and graduates are dealing with this horrendous job market. What are you hearing from your students and former grads?
Nothing good. They're ending up in their parents' in their bedrooms in their parents' houses while they wait for the economy to open up again. So the short-term picture is just stagnation and waiting.
I mean, even before COVID hit, of course, we always heard from the administration that the economy was doing well. I mean, it was doing well for some people. But, you know, grads had a hard time finding a good paying job, especially in very expensive cities, right?
Yeah, I think there's an economic policy problem that we haven't been facing and that we sometimes sort of try to hang on universities when it's only partially their fault. I mean, universities don't really have control over the labor market. And one of the things that we've been seeing over the last 10 or 20 years is an increasing hesitancy to think that sort of middle-skill jobs of the kind that you get when you're looking for when you come out of universities need to be paid as a sort of in a stable, long-term way. So people have shifted jobs to internships, for example. There's a lot of public policy economic issues that are undermining the labor market that universities can't really do anything about.
Jeff, what would you add? What are you hearing from students and recent graduates?
I haven't actually been talking to the recent graduates a lot, but more looking at the kind of scope of the labor market. And, you know, as was mentioned, you know, it's a total collapse for youth entering the labor market. A couple of points I would raise. Normally, we tend to use the term middle skill to talk more about sub-baccalaureate jobs as compared to BA And I think we need to really differentiate these aspects of the market, because when it comes to getting a good job, workers with a BA tend to have a fairly high rate of getting a reasonable job that puts them in the middle class. And so what we're seeing now, and I think this stoppage to the market, it's, you know, what happens over the next 4 months are probably going to be really telling for this cohort of graduates, because in past recessions, we have a lot of scarring effects where their lifetime earnings are put on the, they just don't rise as quickly as previous generations. But it is so hard to tell right now exactly where the impacts of this, I'm calling it a pan session, exactly where they're going to hit and how they're going to hit college graduates. So, for instance, we've had 330,000 new computer science jobs for BAs be created during the pan session. So it's not all doom and gloom, though it is a scary market if you're entering it.
And Christopher, it's even harder for first-generation college students and low-income students. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there's a differentiation across skill type. So, you know, it's easier to get a job with your computer programmer than it is to get a job if you have, you know, more generic interpretive skills. Students that are coming onto the market with a lot of student debt are also have trouble imagining how they're going to get the kind of job that is going to allow them to pay that off. The thing that concerns me is that we're not thinking about this at a sufficient scale and with sufficient ambition. You know, when we've suffered major downturns in the past, and I'm thinking particularly of the Great Depression, we eventually got around to, you know, a massive sort of reconstructive stimulus policy that we called the New Deal. And I think we're going to have to do the same thing for the labor market today. I mean, we already have 30 million unemployed people that graduates are competing with for what are basically, you know, in many cases just entry. How can I level jobs? How can I pay the rent this month while I look for something better? So the way to deal with that is with some kind of a full employment policy, with the, you know, multi-trillion-dollar stimulus that's being held up in the Senate now. I don't think it's primarily a question of, you know, what you majored in, which kind of college you went to. It's a public economic policy problem that we have at the moment.
Well, it's almost a public policy crisis, right? I mean, if you can't even get the Republicans to agree to the additional $600 a week as people are being evicted as we speak. I mean, we had a woman on our show last week who can barely afford food. She had to move out of her apartment and into an RV. So people are really hurting, and the Republican Party is, you know, they're barely budging on this. I mean, they want to give people $400 a month, but they want the states to chip in $100, and the states can't afford that right now.
I wish the Democratic Party sounded as urgent about this as you just did. Well, I'm not seeing that on the Democratic side either. You know, this sense that we're in a major emergency.
Right.
And that we do have the money actually to get through this without just massive suffering and hardship, or what Jeff was calling the, you know, the scarring effects of spending years and years on a market struggling just to get a basic job.
I mean, that's what it feels like, Jeff, is we're just asking for crumbs, and at a point when people are really, really struggling right now. I mean, we need some major, major policy changes.
Yeah, I mean, I think you presented an onion that needs to be unwrapped. There's so much going on right in this whole mess. So one aspect of what my colleague said, you know, about a full employment policy, not only do we have a public policy problem, but we also have a demand-side problem. The last statistics I heard was that there's about 4 or 5 unemployed for every single job opening. So this manure that we've been hearing out in the press about how $600 a week is keeping people from looking for employment is a bunch of malarkey, quite frankly. All the research done on extended UI benefits show that it does not stop people from looking for work. So I think we really need to be cognizant of that fact. I will come back in the defense of the Democrats a little bit. I do think they have raised the flag about how serious of a problem this is for families in the country suffering through this. So at least relative to the Republicans, I would say, without a doubt, there. But, yeah, we have a major crisis. And this gets us to these education problems. We're putting our low-income and minority students in low-graduating institutions and giving them all the debt of college and none of the benefits, and that's in normal times. So all of a sudden we're in the middle of the biggest recession that we've seen since the Great Depression, and equity is not on the table, a lot of these issues. And so we weren't resolving them in boom time, so I don't know what the heck we're going to do during downtimes on these issues.
Right. And for many years, Christopher, we've heard that, like, for example, I'm Gen X. That's right. I'm Gen X. And we've heard that we're not making, we don't have as much wealth as our parents. Like, it's so hard for us to afford a home. But then when you think about Gen Y, they're going to have an even tougher time. I mean, even, you know, the Wall Street Journal had a piece, crisis fall, millennials slammed by second financial crisis fall even further behind. The second pummeling could keep them from accruing the wealth of older generations.
Yeah, I mean, we have to ask the question about whether the, you know, the country's leaders still think that we need a mass middle class. Because for 40 years, generations have been saying what you just said, which is, oh, it's not as good for me as it was for my parents. Yet we haven't just, you know, bit the bullet around some kind of industrial policy that will allow us to rebuild sectors that pay those kinds of wages and that are stable in a global market. We've instead tried to, you know, let sort of ad hoc parts of sectors solve the problem for us, and it really has not worked out.
And also, there's just so many layers to this. I mean, I was reading in UC Santa Barbara's college newspaper about an article about tuition. Tuition for higher education is now the highest it's ever been in history. College in the United States was once affordable. Here in California, it was pretty much free at one point. In 1971, attending a public college cost $8,300 on average. By 2016, the annual cost had risen to more than $20,000. When you factor in books and housing, that could go up to $40,000 at a UC, Christopher. So, I mean, it's hard for people to even afford to go to school because tuition is so high.
Yeah, I actually think this is an opportunity for us to rethink the business model. Because we've responded to economic pressures essentially by, you know, privatizing the payment sources for higher education, including very much in publics. And it's created a debt burden that has completely changed the way that students see their education. You know, it's forced them to think about it mostly in terms of a return on investment, when actually college is not the most efficient form of job training. It also creates cognitive capabilities that are, you know, do the graduate good in every aspect of their lives, but you can't measure that in terms of a salary bump only. So we don't understand higher education correctly as having multiple benefits, many of which cannot be recouped by the individual's wage, that in fact are recouped by society, and which are things that society should therefore pay a much higher share for. So, you know, my sense is that this is an opportunity to think about doing what we did with high school, which is recreate free college, right? The United States invented free high school as a way of boosting the economy and the society by getting more people to go to high school. We did the same thing for college after World War II, and we need to do the same thing again. And it wouldn't actually cost that much money compared to especially the very inefficient aid system that we have today.
Right. And we'll talk about that a little later in the show, but I want to go back to just how we got to this place. Jeff, one of the reasons why tuition is so high is because we've had so much budget cuts, right? We've had so many budget cuts at the state level. Can you talk more about that?
I mean, when we saw through the Great Recession, the demolishing of state budgets, I think that was probably one thing that accelerated the movement of the moving tuition towards the student than away from the state. I'm not actually certain if that how big of an effect that was on a long-term trend. But we really do see differences also on subsidization of public dollar between your public flagships and four-year institutions and your community colleges. So if we're really thinking about moving more and more people through institutions, we have to think about how we allocate the dollars. There are several states, for instance, that mandate 25% of tuition funding per capita, annual per capita, per student funding on a two-year versus a four-year. So if we're going to use the community colleges, as we did following the Vietnam War, to be the shock absorber to get lots of people through college, we really have to think about taking our limited dollars and moving them to where the students are or will be. And so I think this is a complicating issue.
And Christopher, I feel like taxes have to be raised in almost all of the conversations we're having right now. And here's one of my favorite latest facts. According to the Institute for Policy Studies, measured as a percentage of their wealth, the tax obligations of U.S. billionaires decreased a whopping 79% between 1980 and 2018. I mean, that is a massive number.
Yeah. Policy has essentially created a kind of a, you know, plutocratic economic structure, and plutocracies basically don't need mass higher education. You know, they're just, it's not, mass higher education is about middle class societies. It's about more egalitarian access to goods. It's about access to goods on your, you know, because you're in the society, as opposed to access on your ability to pay. So what we've done, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years is allocated higher education quality on the basis of the ability to pay of the particular student. And what that obviously doesn't work because of the price point that most colleges are charging. And so what we've done is created a financial aid system to sort of artificially increase the student's ability to pay in the short run, but then that, of course, means debt in the long run. And the whole thing is ready for a complete overhaul. It's just, it's never worked properly. It's created a grossly unequal higher education system where the outcomes are very different because the resources that schools have are very different. And, you know, as Jeff said before, low-income students tend to go to low-asset or low-revenue colleges. So the inequality that starts in the society just gets baked in or perpetuated by the university system when it depends on, you know, this private market model of ability to pay as it does right now.
What would you add, Jeff?
Well, I agree with a lot of the comments Christopher's making on the kind of the structure of higher education, but I will argue that the economy has been more and more demanding more post-secondary and getting the bang for their buck from a more educated workforce. So I think that's important. On the issue of taxation, the United States has moved from a model where about 70% of the value add went to labor, went to human individuals, and about 30% went to capital. It's now 56% going to labor and 44% going to the owners of capital. And that means changes in the taxation is less to the public coffers, which leads to lower expenditures on the colleges, and then we end up spending the money on people who really don't need it. And if you follow the dollars, the biggest amount of public subsidies, including tax breaks, go to people who really don't deserve it.
Dr. Jeff Strohl is director of Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce. He is co-author of The Merit Myth, How Our Colleges Favor the Rich and Divide America. Christopher Newfield is professor of English at UC Santa Barbara. He runs the blog Remaking the University. He's author of several books, including The Great Mistake, How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. Today, we are talking about the uncertainty faced by so many college students, college graduates, and also universities. If you have a personal story to share, if you're a recent college grad or you have someone in your family and you'd like to share your or their story, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the changes that we need to see? I mean, when you think about it, the changes have been so drastic just in the past couple of decades when you look at how much college costs and the overall cost of living. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. You can also email yourcall, tweet us at yourcall. Radio. I think this is important too, Christopher. Can we just talk about the changes that we've seen in the last couple decades? I'm just thinking about my own story, a first generation college grad. College opened so many doors for me. And I was able to move to San Francisco. This was a couple decades ago. I won't say what year, but I got a room for $300. You know, I was able to get my first job out of college making 24 grand a year. I got a scholarship, luckily, so I didn't have much debt. And you were able to survive on that. I mean, right now I'm seeing rooms going for $1,900. So it's just things have changed so much. Everything is so much more expensive than it was a couple decades ago.
Yeah, I think what Jeff just mentioned is really a key to that, which is that we've shifted from being a labor value-added society to being an asset price inflation society, so that the easiest way to become very wealthy is just to own stuff. It's not to work. And since college is training people to think and then to work, it's putting them in a sort of a secondary position in relation to the ways that you make serious money under contemporary American capitalism. You know, that Thomas Piketty wrote a whole book and now a second book arguing that we're kind of reverting to a long tradition within capitalism of in which asset values grow much more quickly than do labor wages. And this is it's a policy issue that can be changed with public policy, and instead policy for the last 30 or 40 years has been encouraging what you just described, people buying property because they can make much more as landlords than they can make as certainly as postal workers, but also as, in many cases, teachers or nurses or even engineers. Mm. That's something we can fix.
Jeff, what would you
add? I'd actually like to, say that the pandemic or pan-session, as I like to call it, has been a hand grenade in the sandbox, which could actually break that model to pieces. I mean, I've heard that rents in San Francisco have already dropped somewhere between 7 and 10%. And you have people trying to have country living and city wages, but then the firms themselves, Google and Facebook, have been talking about doing price of living for local area wage adjustments, which would be very, very interesting. So that's just one thought. The second one is just always keeping in mind an inflation adjustment, right? So 22,000 5 years ago or two decades ago needs to be almost doubled if you look at the rate of inflation for what it would be today. So we just need to keep that in mind. And I wonder, I don't have an answer to it, how much do we see cities like San Francisco with high demand and low supply of dwellings have that, good storytelling, but for the country as a whole, has it been one that real estate prices and other cost of living haven't kept up with wages? Now, we do know for college-educated workers, real wages have flattened out over the last, 15 years. So clearly at that side of the market, we're seeing not this continued growth that we've seen since 1983.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Dr. Jeff Stroll, director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He's co-author of The Merit Myth, How Our Colleges Favor the Rich and Divide America. Christopher Newfield is professor of English at UC Santa Barbara. He runs the blog Remaking the University, and he's author of several books, including his latest, The Great Mistake, How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. And that is the topic of today's show. We're also talking about the uncertainty faced by college students and recent college graduates. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, investigative journalist Jean Guerrero will join us to talk about her new book, Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. The book explores how the 34-year-old became one of the most influential advisors in the White House. What do you want to know about Stephen Miller? and his agenda if Trump is reelected. Today, we are talking about college grads entering one of the bleakest job markets in history. How are they planning for the next couple years with such a high unemployment rate? We're also talking about what changes are needed to higher education. Today, we're joined by Christopher Newfield, professor of English at UC Santa Barbara. He runs the blog Remaking the University and is author of The Great Mistake, How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. Dr. Jeff Stroll is director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He's co-author of The Merit Myth, How Our Colleges Favor the Rich and Divide America. If you'd like to join us, if you have a story to share, or if there's a change that you would like to see when it comes to higher education, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Joe who says, there's no need to raise taxes on anyone in order for the federal government to pay for all the things that sound policy would have it fund. Taxes are important and can be used to redistribute wealth, to regulate interest rates and unemployment. But this pernicious and durable myth that the federal government needs to levy taxes to fund its spending needs to be retired. The federal government can generate all the revenue it needs by simply having the Fed generate dollars. Christopher, what are your thoughts on that?
Sounds like modern monetary theory to me. I am not an expert on this, but it's a really interesting idea that should be further explored.
Any thoughts, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, what a lot of people don't recognize is the post-war, World War II order was based on the U.S. dollar being the key currency. The statement that the Fed can just print money is based on people willing to take our debt. And the world could change, right? So if the U.S. continues to lose its leadership position and the world decides to go to a petrodollar, go to a Chinese currency, go to some euro currency, that ability to print dollars will go away. Currently, it's true, but it's going to be at the cost borne by our children and our grandchildren or even ourselves if we see the demolishing of the Social Security system. It's not that... we can print money, but it ain't free. So I think we really have to think that one through a lot more, actually. Mm.
Yeah, and Joe, we're going to definitely do a show about debt. There's a new book out that I know you've been asking us to have. Stephanie Kelton, I believe her name is. We're definitely going to have her on soon. Christopher, this kind of also is connected to the piece that you wrote about free college for all. And, I mean, when you look at taxes, for example, in 2017, you go back to the George W. Bush taxes, which the Obama administration extended, and then the Trump administration passed $2 trillion in taxes that mostly went to the wealthy in 2017. And I believe that you touched on this in the piece that you wrote about free college and how we actually pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, we're happy, at least if we're Republicans, to do major tax expenditures in the form of, you know, or the amount of $100 to $200 billion a year, which is what Trump's 2017 tax is costing us. Let me just throw out some numbers, if you want, like a minor numerical blitz, because I think it'll put this in perspective, and we'll see that we don't actually have to talk about massive tax increases, although, you know, shifting the way that we do taxes would be a really good idea. We now spend $175 billion a year at all levels of government on higher education. Which is pretty similar to what we're losing at the federal level from the Trump tax cuts. A tuition buyout for all public universities would cost another $50 billion, right? So it's adding, you know, a little bit around, say, a third more to what we're already spending. To do a quality increase, so to bring the poor colleges' spending per student up to the level of $20,000 a year, which is a fairly decent amount of expenditure for students or for universities that are spending or they're educating first generation and minority majority student populations, that would cost about another $50 billion. So we're talking about adding $100 billion. The big price tag is debt cancellation, which some people talked about, which is another $170 billion on top of that. But let's just stick with the buyout of tuition. We spend $175,000. We'd need to spend another $50,000 it's a pretty small amount of money to completely transform the, you know, the economic, as and I think also the intellectual relationship that students have to higher education.
Wow. So $175 billion is being spent right now, and a tuition buyout would cost another $50 billion. Can you elaborate on what you mean by tuition buyout?
But just the government would, states and feds together, would replace the tuition revenue that is now coming from students. So you would take that back down to zero. I mean, we did a calculation for the state of California, which might bring it a little bit closer to home for the show, to take the all three segments that you mentioned at the top of the hour, put their tuition back to zero. So we're talking about, you know, 450,000 students at Cal State, 280 at UC, close to 2 million in the Cal State system. Everybody pays zero tuition. That money is replaced by the state, and then the state also returns the basic level of per student expenditure, inflation corrected, back to the level of 2000, which was when universities were struggling quite a bit less to cover their bills. That costs the median taxpayer in the state of California an additional $66 a year.
Wow.
Wealthy people will pay more than that per year, several thousand, for example, at the, you know, $500,000, $600,000 salary level. But the median person who is making, you know, $50,000, $55,000 a year is going to pay an extra $66 for free tuition for, you know, around 2 million public university students in the state. Very affordable.
That's so affordable, and it just makes me think about all the doors that would open. I mean, I've read a couple articles, and I don't remember the names of the schools that are offering free tuition right now. And obviously what happens is the enrollment really goes up by drastic numbers because a lot of people want to go to college. So when you would factor that in, Christopher, you know, let's say, okay, for the class of, or for 2022, California colleges are not going to charge you tuition. We would see a drastic increase in enrollment numbers. So what would you tack on, maybe another $5
billion? Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, you can increase to a level of $20,000 quality for 5 million students in units of about $50 billion a year.
Wow.
I mean, it's just, you know, we spent, $2 trillion in the CARES Act. The Democrats would like to spend another $3 trillion in the HEROES Act. You know, and they're arguing about $1, $2, $3 trillion units. This is just—it's not that much money on a national scale, and it's not that much money for a particular state.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff, when you think about this, just the doors that this would open—you know—in low-income households where tuition right now is just not attainable, you could actually tell your child, "Guess what? You can go to school. You can go to college."
Yeah, the way I look at this one, you know, people say we can't afford it, and the retort is we cannot not afford it. Mm-hmm. The benefits and upward lifting in terms of equity and across the board rate, uplift in productivity, I think would be astounding. We've done some work in this area, somewhat related with free college, but more on thinking about what we'd have to do for attaining equity. And we calculate that it would take about 5 to 10 years for the benefits to outweigh the cost of taking all of these students through the systems at different levels, and that it would fully be positive returns in tax revenue and GDP growth after close to about 20 years. And so making these kind of investments would be absolutely dramatically impacting on the individual, especially when we think of in terms of wealth accumulation, because earnings lead to savings, lead to wealth. They won't solve the wealth gap, but they certainly will make individuals' lives that much better. And just to close, my favorite bumper sticker, which will date me to about 1980, was the old one that said, "Wouldn't it be a great world if the Pentagon had to hold a bake sale and the schools had all the money they needed?"
Yep.
Well, I remember that one.
Well, exactly. And you remind me, Jeff, that in this Republican plan, they actually include money for weapons, which for some reason the media aren't spending much time on that. But as people are losing their homes and, you know, struggling to feed their families, they want more money for weapons. So it goes the bumper sticker is still so relevant today.
Yeah.
Well, if you'd like to join us, I just want to repeat this. We need to keep repeating this. Right now, the U.S. government spends $175 billion a year on higher ed. A tuition buyout would cost another $50 billion. $50 billion. And just remember that the tax cuts that were passed 2 years ago cost $2 trillion with a T. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Dr. Jeff Stroll is director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He's co-author of The Merit Myth, How Our Colleges Favor the Rich and Divide America. Christopher Newfield is professor of English at UC Santa Barbara, and author of The Great Mistake, How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in the South Bay. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, maybe just a quick anecdote. When I went to school, which was ages ago, I paid $2,000 a year to go to a small independent college in Southern California. Their tuition is now over, I think it's $30,000 or $40,000 a year. That's just unbelievable to me. But that's really not the issue I wanted to talk about. What I wanted to ask you, maybe you've covered this already, I didn't hear it, but while federal taxes have been declining over a long period of time, especially with these recent Trump tax cuts, take the state of California. You haven't seen the kinds of increases that could offset increases in taxes on the state level that could offset the decreases in the federal taxation. So I'm just curious why, especially when Trump did this, why the Democrats in the state of California didn't say, you know, the only way we're going to get through this is we have to raise taxes in the state of California. Right now they're making tepid efforts, like ballot Prop 13 is going to be on the ballot in California. We'll see what the voters do with that. But it seems to me that there's got to be a complete revision of state taxes in California if they want to get anywhere, get a handle on what you people are talking about so they could actually fund these services like higher education at reasonable levels.
Well, thank you for that, Greg. There is a bill, Assembly Bill 1253 in California, which would raise personal income taxes on people making more than $1 million a year, more than a million. And Governor Gavin Newsom was asked about this last week, and he basically said, I can't comment on what's going on with the legislature in Sacramento. What are your thoughts about that, Christopher? You're a professor of English at UC Santa Barbara.
Well, I think the Democratic governor should support that kind of a wealth tax. I think we need to look at corporate taxes because they're generating about half the revenue, inflation adjusted today, than they did 30 years ago.
Yeah, and according to the LA Times, just back to this bill, over 80,000 people in the U.S. and in California, make more than a million, and we've got 165 billionaires. So again, if anyone wants to maybe make a call or learn more about this, it's Assembly Bill 1253. Thanks for that question, Greg. Let's go to Carlos in San Francisco. Hi, Carlos. Welcome to the show.
How's it going? I'm glad we're
hanging in there. Thank you.
Great. I'm glad we're having this discussion about higher education and income inequality. It seems like there are many policies that can help the young people we're talking about, things like Medicare for All, higher minimum wage, cancellation of student debt, free higher education. So we're discussing how to help these young people, and there are actually active national candidates who are proposing and supporting these policies, but at the same time, voting rates for these young people are very low. So I wanted to get your guest's opinions on how we can get voters to actually support what's in their self-interest.
I'm so glad you brought this up. Thank you for that. Jeff, do you have thoughts on this? Because according to a Gallup poll, a lot of young people, they're not sure whether their state has online voter registration. 25%, only 25% have voted by mail, and there's some concerns that young people aren't really sure how to navigate what we're dealing with right now.
I didn't actually hear all of the callers' questions, so it was related to got the voter registration point.
Yeah, and young, getting people to vote, because there are a lot of candidates who, you know, will take us to a place of possibly having free college in the future.
Oh, my God. I wish I had an answer to this, putting a fire to the heels and say, get to the damn polls, because I know it's going to change the world, but people have to recognize that it actually does some good. And until Trump, I couldn't distinguish between Republicans and Democrats being inept Republicans. And so we're finally at a stage in history where there's a distinguishing line that hopefully will be motivating enough to get people out there. On the getting to online registration, this is public service messaging, and as we know, the current administration is not really willing to fund things that lead to more voting.
Right.
They have been longstanding trying to suppress voting in this country, especially among people who are of low income and of color. So there's no big motivator for the public funds right now to help with this problem.
Mm. Christopher, what would you add?
I couldn't hear the question either. I'm sorry.
How do you get young people to vote for candidates who actually are going to do something about the cost of college and student debt, for example?
I think it starts with making higher ed an issue that can get somebody voted out. The political problem that we have in California, and I think it's true all over the country, is that nobody ever lost their job by cutting universities.
Mm-hmm.
So that it needs to be something that parents, families, students, professors, administrators, college presidents, boards of regents really turn into a major issue. And my concern now is that there's a kind of a complacency among senior leaders and governing boards, particularly even in this moment of crisis, about whether we need sort of a massive infusion of money to get through this. We clearly need a massive infusion of money, but because there's kind of political passivity around higher education, its connection to the labor markets, about labor markets in general, we're not really getting anywhere. So I would love to see this broad front of activism that has been inspired in part by the George Floyd murder and other related events include a kind of an economic rebuilding model as well.
Right.
Can I add one thing here real quickly? One of the issues about this differentiation on public on post-secondary education is discretionary versus non-discretionary dollars, as well as people seeing post-secondary as being almost a consumption good, and so it's not captured by public regulation to the same degree as K-12.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that question. We're going to be talking about these issues next week, but if you do have a young person in your life, please reach out to them and make sure that all their registration data is up to date. I'm also concerned about youth who thought they were going to college and are now going to learn from home. And I'm hoping that they're able to change their registration if it was in another state. So that's really important. So thank you for bringing that up, Greg. I want to ask you both, since we're talking about candidates, we know that Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren made the cancellation of student debt one of their big campaign promises, and a lot of progressives have pushed for this too. Joe Biden has proposed forgiving student debt for those making $25,000 or less, and that seems really low. But during the pandemic, he said that he would forgive $10,000 of debt for all borrowers. Christopher, what are your thoughts on this plan?
I don't know why he's being so cheap.
Yeah.
And Warren got it up to $100,000 as the threshold for forgiveness. I think that's a much better place to start. And I personally liked Sanders' plan better because it creates a whole package based on the principle of student debt being an unfair burden for one or now two generations compared to the generations before. It's not going to cost him that much more to be much more open-handed about this, and I'm not sure why he's holding back.
Jeff, what are your thoughts?
I agree, about the threshold level. I think that's important. I think we should be going up with this. We also need to be very cognizant of equity issues. I mean, I don't think the public is going to support unrestricted debt forgiveness because there's many people who parents can help pay for school, and if they end up taking out debt knowing that it's going to be forgiven, we're kind of creating a new inequity in money. So I think we need to be conscious of that. And as we've seen college become the new baseline, high school is no longer the baseline. We have to start to make colleges a discretionary, a non-discretionary line item, so it's the, it's required, and we get to that point. Thinking about paying for free college like we pay for free K-12 will become more of an appealing idea, knowing that you just can't get anywhere with high school, and college is necessary to even think about economic opportunity today. So the idea of free college ought to be dovetailed with a whole body of thinking about what's called educational adequacy, that we have a baseline that the public sector should be providing, and today it is college.
And we know that the averages are around $20,000, but I mean, some students and grads have $50,000, $100,000 in debt. And I mean, this is really shocking. According to a Bloomberg Businessweek analysis, student loan borrowers are only paying down 1% of their debt every year because the interest rates are so darn high. And today, 1 in 10 students are defaulting on their student loans. I mean, this system is just so brutal to students and grads, Christopher.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous, and I think everybody's totally fed up with it, and I think we're at the point where we can change it. There's another thing I just wanted to throw in here that we haven't talked about yet, which is racism and structural racism. You know, and another thing that that's gotten back on the front page in the last few months is the concept of systemic racism. And it's, I think, the thing that has made it harder for politicians and the public to see the necessity of opening their wallets as a society and creating free college. There is a, you know, concern on the part of white majorities in places like California that they just didn't want to pay for black and brown students in the same way that their parents had paid for white students. You know, are they our children? You know, the answer is obviously yes, but there's just been a kind of racial unease, if not just straight racism, around funding structures. And, you know, Ronald Reagan and other racial wedge politicians, Pete Wilson in the 90s, did a very effective job of denigrating, basically just the concept of mutualization. You know, society's paying for things that no individual person can pay for at the right level together because we all need it, turning that into a controversial idea, and it was largely around the we being, you know, racially diverse now. I think we're getting over that. I think that, you know, this new generation of white folks are cognizant of what structural racism means, that it includes underfunding universities that are minority-majority compared to very well-funded universities when they were white-majority. And so I'm optimistic that we're going to come to a better funding model in the next few years.
Well, I'm so glad you're optimistic, Jeff. What are your thoughts on that?
I hope optimism comes out to play. I'm a little more skeptical on that particular note, but on the issue of structural racism, I think one thing we need to think about is what's a major source of debt for students. It's time in school. And so when we put students into a low graduating institution and they have to work, they're not getting an AA in 2 years, and they're not getting a BA for median is now 6 years. So if you think about these tuition numbers we've been throwing around, first gen and low income and minority students who don't have the same resources and actual knowledge about college going that happens with first gen, end up being in school for a much longer period of time, accruing more debt than someone who goes straight into a four-year institution, and then, as I point out later, so many more drop out that all they have is the damn debt and not the benefit of the college degree. And this aspect of, I think, would fall into that structural racism, this underfunding aspect of schools. I mean, think about the HBCUs, historic black colleges and universities. I mean, it's always a battle to get money to them. And so we definitely need to sort this through. I don't think we're going to do it in the next couple of years, but I pray that we do find a new kind of funding model that takes it into account.
And to add one more fact to this, according to the Hechinger report.
Hechinger.
Thank you. Black college grads are 5 times more likely than white grads to have to default on their loans. And that includes black students who don't complete college or who attend for-profit colleges. So that just exactly what you said, Jeff. Jeff?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, it's to your point. That stat just proves what you just said.
Right, yeah. I mean, so we look across this whole sectorial issue, and the differences in graduation. You brought up the for-profits. I mean, Christmas, why don't we return to gainful employment? If we're going to use our college system as a workforce training apparatus, so 89% of all students go to college for a job, we really need to think about, does it give a return? Is somebody's basic earnings enough to pay for the price of college? And with the Trump administration, we took away the whole stick that was behind gainful employment. It has turned into the college scorecard, but lets you look at earnings by program, by institution around the country, so that we have open to transparency but not a regulatory window into this issue.
Dr. Jeff Stroll is director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He is co-author of The Merit Myth, How Our Colleges Favor the Rich and Divide America. Dr. Stroll, thanks for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Christopher Newfield is professor of English at UC Santa Barbara. He runs the blog Remaking the University, and he's the author of The Great Mistake, How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. Professor Newfield, thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for covering this, Rose. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And we will definitely continue to cover this. Again, the fact that Christopher cited, right now the U.S. government spends $175 billion a year on higher ed. Paying for everyone's tuition could cost another $50 billion. Imagine what we could accomplish if we did that. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And I hope you can join us tomorrow. We'll be joined by investigative journalist Jean Guerrero. We'll talk about her new book, Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. You can find more about the show and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.